Hello, my lady. I'm Alfred Gowan.
Excuse me.
The wealthy Duke was used to being chased until he met the one woman who walked away. Nancy Holcomb almost did not come. She had been sitting at her kitchen table two nights before the house party, staring at an unfinished column of estate accounts, her quill hovering over a letter she was already composing in her head. A polite refusal. Reasonable. Responsible. Entirely like her. Then Paula knocked so hard the candle flickered. Nancy. Close the ledger. Pack one trunk. We leave at dawn. I will not hear another word about it. So Nancy packed. She arrived last at the coastal estate, stepping out of the carriage alone with a single travel trunk, while the others were already inside, already laughing, already performing. The estate was breathtaking. Limestone columns, ocean wind carrying fine linen curtains through open windows. The kind of beauty that made you stop walking just to acknowledge it. Nancy stopped for exactly 3 seconds. Then she found a quiet chair near the shoreline, opened her leather-bound book, and disappeared into it. She did not know that across that same stretch of beach, the most pursued Duke in England had just arrived. And for the first time in his life, every woman at that gathering was watching him, except one. What happened next changed everything. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for more stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise, and where the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button right now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below, let me know where you're watching from and what's on your mind. Don't forget to like, share, and hit that notification bell so you never miss a moment of the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now let's dive in. The carriage rolled to a stop on a path of pale gravel, and Nancy Holcomb was the last one out. She had known she would be. Paula had practically shoved her into the carriage at dawn, and even then Nancy had spent the first hour of the journey mentally reorganizing the estate accounts she had left unfinished on her desk, cataloging what Dorset's steward could manage without her, and what would likely fall apart entirely. By the second hour, she had surrendered to the rhythm of the wheels and allowed herself, cautiously, to look out the window. The coastline appeared before the estate did, a long silver stretch of water, sitting heavy and still beneath a pale morning sky, the kind of ocean that did not ask anything of you. Nancy watched it for a long moment before the horses turned and the manor came into full view. She stepped out of the carriage and simply stood there. The estate rose against the sky in pale limestone, grand and unhurried, its columns catching the morning light in a way that made the whole structure seem to breathe. The windows were tall and generously proportioned, and through several of them the white linen curtains moved softly with the sea breeze, as though the house itself were sighing with contentment. A long stone terrace curved toward the water, bordered by low hedges and iron lanterns that had burned through the night and were only now beginning to dim. The gardens between the house and the shoreline were entirely wild, in a deliberate, cultivated way, seagrasses bending in clusters, salt roses opened flat against their trellises. The smell of brine and green things mixing together into something that had no name, but settled immediately in the chest. Nancy picked up her single travel trunk, declined the footman's second offer of assistance with a quiet word of thanks, and walked toward the entrance. The sound reached her before she opened the door. Laughter, layered and overlapping, the particular pitch of women who had not seen each other in months and were making up for it loudly and without apology. Nancy felt the corner of her mouth lift. Paula found her first. She came through the entrance hall at speed, her warm brown eyes wide with theatrical outrage, arms already extended. "Nancy," she said, "you are outrageously late, and I am furious with you, and I am also extremely glad you are here." She pulled her into an embrace that was less a greeting and more a small collision. Nancy laughed. "A real one. The kind that came without preparation. I was on time," she said. "Everyone else was simply early." Paula stepped back and assessed her with the focused attention she normally reserved for things she suspected were not quite right. "You packed one trunk. I need one trunk. We are here for 10 days. I am aware of how many days we are here for. Paula opened her mouth, reconsidered, and instead took Nancy by the arm and steered her firmly into the interior of the house. The entrance hall was wide and cool, its floors pale stone, its walls hung with sea paintings in heavy gilt frames. Through the open doors at the far end, Nancy could see the terrace and beyond it the glittering line of water. Elizabeth was already arranged in the drawing room in the way she arranged herself everywhere, positioned near the best light, her silk morning dress a precise shade of rose that no one would call accidental. She looked up when Nancy entered and offered a smile that was entirely warm and only slightly assessing. "You made it," she said. I had begun to compose a very sympathetic letter of understanding. Nancy set her trunk down near the door. I appreciate the restraint in not sending it. Camille was cross-legged on the window seat with a cup of tea balanced on her knee, her fair hair still loose from sleep, entirely unbothered by the fact that the other two had clearly been awake and dressed for hours. She raised the cup in greeting. "There is coffee on the sideboard," she said. "It is very good. Someone here actually knows how to manage a proper kitchen." Simone appeared from the corridor that led toward the rear rooms, composed and unhurried as she always was, a small book already tucked under one arm. She gave Nancy a long, quiet look. "You almost did not come," she said. It was not a question. Nancy considered denying it. She did not bother. The ledgers were not going to balance themselves. Simone's expression did not change, but something in it softened by a degree. "They never do," she said. "That is rather the point of getting away from them." The rooms were divided between the upper floors of the main house and two attached guest wings that faced the water, and Nancy was given a corner room on the second floor with a stone balcony barely wide enough for a single chair and a view that made the narrowness entirely forgivable. She stood on it for a few minutes after she had unpacked, watching the tide come in, feeling something she did not immediately know what to do with. It was not quite happiness. It was closer to the relief of putting down something heavy you had been carrying for so long you had stopped noticing the weight. She went downstairs, collected her leather-bound book from her trunk, and walked directly to the shoreline. The beach below the estate's terrace was private, accessible only through a low iron gate set into the garden wall, and in the mid-morning it was quiet enough that she could hear the individual movement of each wave. She found a wooden chair someone had placed near the water's edge, settled into it, opened her book to the page she had marked 3 weeks ago, and not returned to since, and began to read. Paula came to find her an hour later, carrying a plate of sliced bread and soft cheese, and wearing an expression that suggested she found the entire situation both predictable and endearing. "You walked past a drawing room full of people," she said, "to come and sit alone on a beach." "I walked past a drawing room full of people," Nancy said without looking up, "to come and sit in excellent company." Paula sat down in the grass beside her chair, uninvited and entirely comfortable. She ate a piece of bread and looked out at the water. After a moment, she said, quietly and without preamble, "I am glad you came, Nancy. I mean that." Nancy lowered her book slightly. "I know you do." That first afternoon passed in the gentle, unhurried way that only the first afternoon of a long-awaited holiday can. Lunch was taken on the terrace. The five of them gathered around a table that caught the full south-facing sun, talking over each other with the easy familiarity of women who had known each other long enough to have no performance left between them. Elizabeth described in precise and entertaining detail the social disasters of the London season just concluded. Camille had strong opinions about everything and delivered them cheerfully. Simone listened more than she spoke and said things, when she did speak, that landed with a quiet accuracy that occasionally silenced the table entirely. Paula laughed at nearly everything. Nancy ate her food and listened and felt, cautiously and with full awareness, that she was feeling it, something close to lightness. That evening they dined inside, the windows thrown open to the cooling air, candles lit along the length of the table, the ocean a steady presence beyond the glass. It was the kind of meal that lasted 3 hours without anyone noticing, and Nancy went to bed that night later than she had in months, her book still unfinished on the nightstand, the sound of the water coming through the gap in the balcony door. She woke before anyone else. That was her habit, and had been for years, the early morning quiet being the one part of any day that reliably belonged to her alone. She dressed simply, made her way down to the kitchen, and found a fire already burning low in the hearth, and a kettle close enough to hot that she could manage. She made tea, took it outside to the terrace, and watched the sky do what it does in the hour before full daylight. That slow, soft negotiation between darkness and color that never quite looked the same twice. She did not notice, or did not think to notice, that the large estate adjacent to the eastern garden wall also had a light burning upstairs. The second day brought warmth and a cleaner breeze off the water, and by mid-morning the five of them had migrated to the beach in various degrees of leisure. Elizabeth had arranged herself on a long chair with the careful precision of someone who understood that comfort and visibility were not mutually exclusive. Camille had brought her sketchbook and was working in it with intense concentration. Paula had already struck up a conversation with two women from a neighboring villa and was laughing at something one of them had said. Simone sat with her feet in the cool sand, eyes half closed, entirely at peace. Nancy was reading. She was deep enough into her chapter that she did not hear the change in the atmosphere before she felt it. A shift, subtle and collective. The particular quality of silence that moves through a group of people when something has arrived that commands attention without demanding it. She looked up. He came down the private path from the eastern estate, in the unhurried way of a man who had never needed to hurry for anything in his life. Dark linen trousers, a white shirt open at the collar, a dark coat that he was in the process of removing as he walked, folding it over one arm with the casual efficiency of someone accustomed to managing themselves without assistance. His dark hair was slightly disordered by the sea wind, and he did not appear to notice or care. He was not looking at the beach. He was looking at the horizon, something in his expression suggesting that the horizon was the only thing out here he had specifically come to see. The resort staff rearranged themselves first, the quiet, practiced redistribution of attention around a significant arrival, subtle enough that most people would not notice it consciously, but would feel it nonetheless. Then the two women from the neighboring villa stopped their conversation mid-sentence. Then Elizabeth sat up. Paula's head turned so fast, she nearly upset the small table beside her. She said nothing for a full 3 seconds, which was, for Paula, extraordinary. Nancy registered a tall, well-built gentleman of evident social consequence walking toward the water. She noted the quality of his coat, the particular ease of his posture, and the fact that the staff had quietly arranged themselves at a respectful remove. She placed him, accurately, as someone of significant rank who had chosen this particular stretch of coast for the same reason most people of significant rank chose private coastal estates, which was to be left alone. She returned to her book. Behind her, she heard Paula say, in a low and reverent tone she normally reserved for remarkable architecture and very good pastry, "Who in the name of all that is decent is that man?" Elizabeth's voice came back cool and controlled, but with something underneath it that was neither. "His name is Alfred Gowan. He is the Duke of Ashworth. He has an income that would make your eyes water, and an estate in 3 counties, and he has not, to anyone's knowledge, shown serious interest in a single woman in 4 London seasons. Paula considered this. "And he is staying next door. It appears so." There was a pause during which Nancy turned a page. "Nancy," Paula said. "Nancy, I am reading, Paula. The Duke of Ashworth is standing 40 feet from us." Nancy turned another page. "Then he is welcome to the ocean view," she said. "It is quite good from here." The day continued. Alfred Gowan walked to the water, stood there for a considerable time, and then settled into a chair that had been quietly placed for him at a discreet remove from the main gathering. He had brought nothing with him. He did not read. He did not converse. He sat and looked at the water with the focused stillness of someone engaged in a private and serious occupation that happened to look, from the outside, like doing nothing at all. Every woman on that beach was acutely aware of him for the entirety of the afternoon. Nancy finished 4 chapters. The welcome dinner that evening had been arranged by the estate's hosting family. a generous and socially enthusiastic couple named the Hartfords, who had thrown open the long dining terrace and set a table for 18 directly on the sand. Paper lanterns had been strung between iron posts, their warm light catching the white tablecloths and the glassware and the faces of the assembled guests in equal measure. The sound of the waves ran underneath every conversation like a low, continuous note. Nancy arrived with her friends and found her place near the middle of the table, which suited her precisely. She could observe the full length of the gathering from there without being at its center, and the food, she had been told by a rather enthusiastic Hartford daughter, was exceptional. Alfred Gowan was seated at the far end of the table. She noticed, as everyone noticed, because it was not possible not to notice him in an enclosed gathering. He had changed into a dark evening coat and white cravat, the formality sitting on him with the ease of something worn so long it had ceased to be an effort. He spoke to the gentleman on his left with measured attention, answered questions from the woman on his right with courtesy, and had the particular quality of presence that made him easy to locate in a room without his doing anything specific to be located. Elizabeth was three seats down from him and had arranged her expression into its most becoming register of interested composure. Two other young women across the table were conducting what they believed to be subtle campaigns for his attention. The campaigns were not subtle. Alfred was polite to everyone and drawn to no one. The dinner moved through its courses with the unhurried elegance of a well-managed household. Conversation expanded and contracted, topics risen and set aside, laughter breaking out in clusters and then subsiding. Nancy ate her food and listened, and occasionally spoke when something was said that warranted a response, and did not speak when it did not. It was during the clearing of the fish course that it happened. One of the serving staff, an older woman whose silver hair was pinned back beneath a white cap, reached across the far end of the table to collect a large covered dish. She had been on her feet since before the guests arrived, and it showed, not in her expression, which remained composed and professional, but in the small, careful way she had been distributing her weight between steps for the past hour. The dish was heavier than she had accounted for, or her grip was not what she intended it to be. Either way, the dish shifted, and with it went two smaller plates and a scattering of silverware, clattering onto the stone with a sound that silenced the entire table at once. Every guest at that dinner made the same calculation in the same half second, whether to look away, whether to speak, whether to wait for someone else to manage it. The calculation took long enough that no one moved. Nancy was already out of her chair. Not quickly, not dramatically, not in the manner of someone making a statement. She simply moved, the way a person moves when they see something that requires attention and they are not in the habit of waiting for someone else to provide it. She crouched down beside the older woman, gathered the fallen silverware without ceremony, stacked the plates with practiced efficiency, and said something quiet that made the woman's shoulders drop an inch from where they had risen in mortification. The woman laughed, softly and with what was clearly genuine relief, and Nancy straightened, set the recovered items on the table, and returned to her seat. The table resumed its conversation within moments. Nancy picked up her fork and continued eating. Alfred Gowan had not resumed his conversation. He was looking at her with an expression that was not easily categorized. Not surprise, exactly. Not admiration, exactly. Something more precise than either. The look of a man who has been searching for a very specific thing for a very long time and has just, without warning, encountered it in a place he was not expecting. He did not look away for a considerable moment. Nancy did not notice, because she was not watching him. She was listening to Camille describe the particular engineering challenge of the Hartford's garden fountain, which had apparently been installed incorrectly in some interesting way, and she was finding it genuinely amusing. The next morning was cooler, the sky holding a thin layer of cloud that softened the light without obscuring it entirely. Nancy had risen early again, made her way through the kitchen quietly, and decided, on an impulse that surprised her slightly, to walk into the village rather than sit on the terrace. She wanted new candles for her room, and a particular kind of writing paper that the estate's supply did not include, and the village was only a mile down the coastal road, which was a perfectly reasonable distance. She found the shop she was looking for on a narrow side street, one turn off the main square. A small, densely stocked establishment that sold stationery, candles, dried goods, and approximately 40 other categories of item, in a space designed for perhaps 10. The proprietress, a small woman of brisk efficiency and minimal conversation, pointed her toward the writing paper without being asked, which Nancy appreciated. She was examining the candles when the door opened behind her. She knew, before she turned, from the slight pause in the proprietress's manner, the small adjustment in attention that happened around certain people. Alfred Gowan had to duck slightly to clear the doorframe. He straightened inside the shop, looked around with the expression of a man who had expected a different kind of establishment, registered Nancy standing 3 feet away with a candle in each hand, and said nothing for a moment. Nancy looked at him without rearranging her expression into anything other than what it was, which was mildly curious. She set one of the candles down. They made their selections without ceremony. Alfred requested ink and a new penknife from the proprietress, who produced both from behind the counter with practiced speed. Nancy paid for her paper and candles, and was calculating whether it would be more awkward to leave immediately or wait while he completed his transaction when Alfred said, without particular preamble, "You helped the woman last night. The one who dropped the dishes." Nancy picked up her parcel. She needed help. He considered that. Everyone else was deciding whether to pretend it had not happened. "Most people find that easier," Nancy said. Alfred looked at her steadily. "Do you find it easier?" "No," she said it simply, without apology or elaboration. He was quiet for a moment. Then, with the air of a man making a decision that was smaller than it appeared, he held the door for her as they both moved toward the exit. They stepped out into the cool morning air together, and neither of them immediately moved to go their separate ways. They walked, by what seemed like mutual unspoken agreement, in the direction of the small tea room that occupied the ground floor of the building on the corner of the square. It was an unspoken arrangement arrived at through the slight synchronization of their steps, and confirmed by neither of them suggesting otherwise. Inside, the tea room was quiet at this hour. Three other tables occupied. The windows steamed softly from the kitchen. They sat across from each other, and a young girl brought tea without being asked, setting it between them with the confidence of someone who considered this the obvious outcome of two people sitting down together. They talked for a long time, not about the house party, and not about the social calendar of the season just past, and not about any of the topics that had occupied the dinner table the previous evening. They talked about practical things, real things. Nancy described the particular difficulty of managing an estate whose income had been structured in the previous generation for entirely different economic circumstances and had not been adjusted since. She spoke without self-pity and without embellishment, using the precise language of someone who had spent years thinking carefully about a problem that no one around her considered worth thinking about. Alfred listened in the way that people rarely listen, without preparing his response while she was still speaking, without layering her words over his own prior understanding of the subject. He asked questions that were specific and showed he had understood what she had actually said rather than what he had expected her to say. He told her, without particular modesty, that the administration of a large ducal estate presented its own version of exactly the problem she was describing, except compounded by the involvement of solicitors who had been retained for so long they considered themselves irreplaceable and acted accordingly. Nancy laughed at that. "A real one." He looked at her when she laughed, and something in his expression shifted in a way he did not appear to notice himself. They were in the tea room for nearly 2 hours. When they finally stood to leave, the morning had moved past noon into the beginning of afternoon, and the square outside was fuller than it had been. They walked back in the direction of the coastal road, and the conversation continued as they walked, easy and unself-conscious, the kind of exchange that happens between two people who have somehow, within a very short time, dispensed with the usual scaffolding. At the point where the road forked, one path toward the Hartford estate and one toward the adjacent property, they stopped. Alfred said, with the direct simplicity that she had already noticed was characteristic of him, "I think we will speak again." Nancy looked at him levelly, I imagine we are at the same stretch of coastline for another 8 days. He almost smiled. That was not quite what I meant. She held his gaze for a moment. Then she picked up her parcel and walked back toward the estate. And she did not look back. Not because she was performing indifference, but because she was thinking. And she thought better when she was moving. That night was warm, and Nancy could not sleep. She was not anxious, exactly. She was thinking too clearly, which was a different problem. She took her book to the balcony and read by the light of the candle she had purchased that morning, sitting with her feet tucked under her in the narrow chair, the ocean a continuous sound below. She had been there perhaps half an hour when she became aware, in the peripheral way one becomes aware of things on quiet nights, that the balcony to the east was occupied. The adjacent estate's upper terrace extended to within perhaps 20 feet of her balcony, separated by the garden wall and a gap of open air. Alfred was standing at its far edge, a glass in one hand, looking at the water. He had changed out of his evening coat and was in his shirt sleeves, which for a man of his rank and the hour was as close to informal as the era permitted. He had not seen her yet. Nancy said nothing for a moment. Then, because silence in these circumstances felt more deliberate than speech, she said, simply, "You cannot sleep either." He turned. His expression, when he found her in the candlelight, was not startled. It was the expression of a man who finds exactly what he expected in an unexpected place. "No," he said. "I find sleep difficult away from my own house." Nancy considered that. "What is it about your own house that makes it easier?" Alfred was quiet for a moment. "The predictability, I think. I know what every noise is. I know what every silence means. Away from it, I spend the first several nights simply cataloging the unfamiliar." Nancy understood that precisely. "I spend most of my nights cataloging the estate accounts," she said, "which is its own kind of unfamiliarity, since the numbers are different every time." He turned to face her more fully across the gap of air between the two balconies. The light was low, and the distance was enough that she could see his expression, but not read it in detail. "Does it ever get easier?" he asked. "The responsibility of it. The weight of being the one who holds it all together." Nancy was quiet for a moment before she answered, because the question deserved a real answer and not a comfortable one. "No," she said finally. "But you get better at carrying it. You stop expecting it to be lighter, and you find better ways to distribute the load." Alfred was silent for a long moment. "That is the most honest answer I have received to that question. Have you asked it often?" "Never," he said. "I have never asked anyone that question before." Nancy looked at him across the darkness. This man who had every material comfort the era could provide, and carried something heavy behind his eyes nonetheless. And she felt the first small movement of something she did not immediately name, and was not certain she wanted to examine. She returned to her book. He remained on his balcony for a long time after, and neither of them spoke again that night. But the silence between them was not empty. It was the kind of silence that meant something had begun. "Now, before we go any further, I want to ask you something. Have you ever been the steady one? The responsible one? The one who almost canceled because someone had to stay behind and hold things together? This story is for you. If you are not yet part of the family, hit that subscribe button right now. Drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. Your thoughts are always welcome here. And I'd love to hear your take on tonight's story. Most importantly, your presence here means more than you know. The best is still ahead. Welcome to the family." The gala was held on the 6th evening, hosted not by the Hartfords but by a man named Reuben Young, who owned the largest private estate on that stretch of coastline and who had, by all accounts, organized the evening primarily so that everyone present would have an opportunity to observe that he owned the largest private estate on that stretch of coastline. The ballroom was genuinely impressive. Nancy would give him that. It occupied the entire eastern wing of the Young estate, its ceiling vaulted and painted with pastoral scenes in muted gold and green, its floor a pale, polished marble that caught the light of 3 enormous chandeliers and threw it back in fragments across every surface. The tall windows along the south wall had been thrown open to the night air, and the sound of the ocean came through them as a steady undertone beneath the orchestra stationed at the far end of the room. Flowers had been arranged in large urns at every pillar, white and deep violet, their scent moving through the warm air in currents. Nancy stood near the window with a glass of lemonade and watched the room arrange itself. Elizabeth had arrived earlier in the evening and had already positioned herself beautifully near the central gathering of guests, her deep gold silk catching the chandelier light in exactly the way it had been selected to do. Camille was in conversation with two gentlemen near the refreshment table, animated and entirely in her element. Paula had found someone amusing within the first 10 minutes and was laughing in the generous, unguarded way that made people want to be near her. Simone stood slightly apart from the main current of the room, observant and unhurried, her dark eyes moving across the assembled company with the quiet attention of someone reading a very long document. Alfred arrived 20 minutes after the hour, which was late enough to be noticed and early enough not to be dramatic about it. He came in through the main entrance with two other gentlemen of evident rank, spoke briefly to Reuben Young at the threshold, with the courtesy of someone discharging a social obligation efficiently, and then moved into the room proper. Within 4 minutes, he had been approached by 6 people. Within 8, he had extracted himself from the majority of those conversations with a politeness so practiced it appeared effortless. Nancy watched none of this. She was looking at the ocean through the open window. She became aware of Reuben Young approximately 30 seconds before he spoke to her, in the way one becomes aware of a change in the room's air pressure before the weather actually shifts. He was a man of perhaps 50, impeccably dressed in a dark coat and white waistcoat that had been fitted to suggest a slimmer figure than the one currently occupying it. His face carried the particular expression of a man who considered social gatherings his natural domain, and everyone present a guest in the territory of his authority. He stopped beside her with the deliberate ease of a man who had planned the approach. "Miss Holcomb," he said, with the warmth of someone who had just invented warmth and was rather pleased with the invention, "we are honored to have you. I understand you have been spending your days by the water, reading, I am told." Nancy looked at him with the calm attention she gave to most things. "Yes," she said. Reuben smiled the smile of a man preparing to say something he had prepared. How industrious. He let the pause expand just enough to carry its intended weight, though I confess, a young woman of your standing at an occasion of this nature, rather absorbed in books when the rest of the company enjoys the social pleasures, one wonders if the season has lost some of its appeal for you. Or perhaps, he continued, turning slightly so that the nearest cluster of guests could hear him without appearing to be the audience he had specifically designed them to be, "the management of a modest estate has made the more elevated pursuits of the ton seem rather beyond reach." The nearest conversations paused in the way conversations do when something worth attending to has been said aloud. Nancy did not change her expression. She held her glass with the same easy composure she had maintained throughout, and she was in the process of forming a response that was both accurate and sufficiently final when a voice came from her left, unhurried and entirely clear. "The management of an estate," Alfred said, carrying the particular quality of projection that comes not from volume, but from absolute certainty, "is not a lesser pursuit than the ones available in a London ballroom. It is a considerably more demanding one." He had come to stand beside her without fanfare, without the social performance of a rival. He was simply there, his attention on Reuben Young, with an expression that was not hostile and was not warm, and was therefore, in its precise neutrality, more authoritative than either would have been. "Miss Holcomb," Alfred continued, "administers an estate whose complexity would occupy most men of business for the better part of a working week. She does so with a precision and a practical intelligence that I have found, in a brief acquaintance, to be genuinely uncommon. The season's social pleasures are available to anyone with a suitable wardrobe and an afternoon to spare. The kind of competence she brings to her responsibilities is not." He said it without flourish, without the performance of chivalry. He said it the way a man states a fact he has verified personally and considers settled. The nearest cluster of guests had gone entirely quiet. Reuben Young's smile had not disappeared, but it had thinned considerably at the edges, the way a garment thins when it has been stretched past its designed capacity. He produced a laugh that was intended to suggest he had been speaking lightly all along, and that Alfred had perhaps taken a gentle jest rather more seriously than warranted. Naturally. Naturally. No slight intended whatsoever, Miss Holcomb. Nancy looked at him steadily. None taken, she said, and turned back to the window. The conversation around them resumed. Reuben Young moved away with the careful pace of a man who has decided the far side of the room requires his attention urgently. Alfred remained beside her for a moment. He did not say anything further, and neither did she. But the silence between them was not uncomfortable. It was the silence of two people who have just been through something together and are allowing it to settle. After a moment, Nancy said, without turning from the window, "You did not have to do that." Alfred was quiet for a beat. "No," he agreed. "I know." She looked at him then, directly and without the usual social mediation of a glance. He met her gaze without adjustment. There was something in his eyes in that moment that was neither triumph nor expectation. It was simpler than either. It was the look of a man who had done precisely what he meant to do and required nothing in return for it. Nancy returned to the window. The ocean moved in the darkness below, indifferent and continuous. She stayed at the gala for another hour and then excused herself to the Hartfords and walked back along the coastal path to the estate alone, the lanterns along the path throwing small warm circles onto the pale gravel. The air was cooler away from the ballroom and smelled of salt and the night-blooming things in the garden. She walked slowly, which was not her habit, and thought about nothing in particular, which was even less her habit. Simone was waiting on the terrace when she arrived. Not waiting in the way of someone who had been watching for her, waiting in the way of someone who had known she would come back and had chosen to be there when she did. She was sitting in one of the iron chairs with a shawl around her shoulders and a cup of something warm between her hands, and she looked up when Nancy came through the garden gate with an expression that said she had several things to say and had been organizing them for some time. Nancy sat down in the chair beside her. She did not ask how Simone had known she would return early. Simone always knew. "He defended you," Simone said, "without being asked, without making theater of it." Nancy was quiet. "And you walked home." "I wanted air." Simone looked at her for a long moment with the particular patience of a woman who has watched someone she loves make the same mistake in several different directions and has decided this time to name it plainly. "Nancy," she said, "you are doing the thing you do with the estate accounts." Nancy glanced at her. "You are looking at something real and valuable, and instead of accepting what it is, you are auditing it. You are checking it for errors. You are looking for the line that does not balance, so that you have a reason to close the ledger and put it away. That is not what I am doing." Simone's expression did not shift. "That is precisely what you are doing. You have been doing it since the tea room. You have been doing it since the balcony. And you were doing it tonight when a man stood beside you and told a room full of people the truth about who you are. And your response was to turn back to the window and then walk home alone." Nancy said nothing for a moment. The sea moved in the darkness below them. "I am not performing disinterest," she said finally. "I genuinely do not know what to do with it." Simone's voice was gentle, but it did not soften its point. "I know that. That is what I am trying to tell you. You know exactly what to do with a ledger that does not balance. You know exactly what to do with an estate that is not managed correctly. But something real, something that has no formula and no certain outcome, your instinct is to close it before it can cost you anything." Nancy looked at her hands. "You are afraid," Simone said quietly. "Not of him. Of what happens to you if you let yourself want something and it turns out to be exactly what it appeared to be. Because then you would have to stop running. And you have been running for a very long time." The terrace was quiet except for the water. Nancy sat with that for a long while, and Simone did not try to fill the silence, because she understood that some things need space in order to be seen clearly. "Eventually," Nancy said, in a voice that was careful and precise in the way her voice got when she was being honest about something that cost her something, "what if I let it be real and it changes who I am. Simone turned to look at her fully. Then she said, with a simplicity that landed like a clean, true note, "The right person does not change who you are, Nancy. They make it safer to be exactly that." Nancy did not respond. But she did not look away. She went to bed that night and lay awake for a long time, and in the morning, she rose before dawn, as she always did, and went to the shoreline and sat in the wooden chair with her book open in her lap, and did not read a single word of it. The sound of footsteps on the gravel path reached her before she looked up. Alfred was walking down from the garden gate in the early gray light, his coat on against the morning cool, his expression carrying the particular quality of a man who has made a decision and is now executing it without further deliberation. He did not look like a man who had spent the night organizing this moment. He looked like a man who had woken up, understood what needed to be said, and come to say it. He stopped a few feet from her chair. "Good morning," he said. Nancy closed her book. "Good morning." He was quiet for a moment, looking at the water, and then he looked at her with the directness that she had understood. By now, was simply the way he was. Not a performance of confidence, simply the absence of the need to obscure things. "I leave on Friday," he said. "My steward has written twice and my solicitor once, which means the estate can manage another 4 days without me, but not five." He paused. "I am not telling you this to create urgency. I am telling you because I intend to be honest with you about the facts of the situation, and I think you deserve to have all of them." Nancy held his gaze. "I would like your permission," Alfred continued, with the careful and entirely sincere formality of a man who understood that what he was asking was not a small thing and intended to treat it accordingly, "to call on you when I am in your county, not through intermediaries, not through the social architecture of the season, directly. I would like to come and find you where you actually are and speak to you as I have spoken to you here." Nancy did not respond immediately, and he did not try to fill the space where her response would be. He waited, with the patience of a man who was accustomed to waiting for things that were worth waiting for. She looked at him, this man in his dark coat in the early light, who had sat across from her in a small tea room and listened without an agenda, who had stood beside her in a ballroom and spoken the truth without performance, who had stood on his balcony in the dark and asked her a question he had never asked anyone before. She looked at him, and she looked at herself, at the woman who had almost canceled, who had packed one trunk and sat down by the water with a book, and told herself that was enough. It had been enough. For a very long time, it had been entirely enough. She was not certain it was enough anymore. "I manage my own correspondence," she said at last, "and my own schedule, and I do not adjust either of those things to accommodate anyone else's convenience." Alfred's expression did not change, but something in it settled, like a weight coming to rest on solid ground. "I would not expect you to," he said. "Then you may call," Nancy said, "when you are in the county." He held her gaze for one more moment, and in that moment, there was something between them that was not yet anything with a name, but was real enough to have a temperature, warm and steady as a coal, kept carefully through the night. Then he inclined his head, with a gravity that was genuine and not ceremonial, and turned and walked back up the path toward the garden gate. Nancy opened her book. She read the same sentence 4 times before she gave up, and simply sat with the ocean. She returned to the estate, as the household was beginning its morning, the kitchen already producing the smell of bread and the sound of activity through the open windows. She went inside through the side entrance, hung her shawl on the hook in the corridor, and walked toward the drawing room, intending to find coffee and an unoccupied corner. Elizabeth was already there, alone, which was unusual for this hour. She was sitting not in her customary chair near the window, but on the settee nearest the cold hearth, her hands folded in her lap with the particular stillness of someone who has been sitting there for some time without moving. Her hair was not yet fully dressed. Her eyes, when she looked up, were red at the edges. Nancy stopped in the doorway. Elizabeth looked at her for a long moment, and then she said, without any of the social architecture she usually placed around everything she said, "I owe you an apology." Nancy came into the room and sat down in the chair across from her. I have not been, Elizabeth began, and then stopped. She started again. I have been watching you this week, not in the way friends watch each other, in the way that is really about watching yourself and not liking what you see. Nancy was quiet and still. Elizabeth's voice was steady, but only just. I have spent the better part of 4 seasons in London, she said, doing everything correctly, wearing the right things and saying the right things and standing in the right light at the right events. And I have been so certain that was what it required, that it was the performance that made you visible, that if you curated it carefully enough, the right person would see the curation and want it. She stopped, her hands tightened slightly in her lap, and then Alfred Gowan walked into a room and looked straight past every curated thing in it, she said, and found you reading a book on a beach, and I was angry. I was genuinely, privately angry, and I am not proud of it. Not because of him, she added quickly, with the honesty of someone who has had enough time alone with the truth to have sorted it properly. I do not want him specifically. I want what he represents. I want someone to look past the performance and find something worth looking at. Her voice broke on the last sentence, quietly and without drama. Nancy leaned forward slightly. Elizabeth pressed on. What I am apologizing for, she said, is that my anger made me small toward you, in small ways that you may not have even noticed, but that I noticed. And you have never been anything but entirely yourself, which is all you have ever been, and somehow that has always been enough. And for a long time I have told myself that was simply luck or circumstance, and not something I needed to examine about myself. She looked up. Her eyes were bright and direct in the way Elizabeth's eyes rarely were, stripped of their careful management. It is not luck, she said. You are just not afraid of being seen as you are, and I am terrified of it. I have been terrified of it for years, and I did not know how to say that until right now. Nancy reached across and covered Elizabeth's hands with her own. There was a long silence in the room, the kind that comes not from discomfort, but from the relief of something that has been held too long, finally being set down. Outside the windows, the morning had fully arrived, light moving across the garden in long, pale shapes, the sound of the others beginning to stir in the rooms above. You are seen, Elizabeth, Nancy said finally, and she said it with the quiet certainty of someone stating a fact. By all of us. You always have been. Elizabeth pressed her lips together and looked at the ceiling for a moment, in the way people do when they are managing themselves. Then she exhaled, and when she looked back down, something in her face was different. Not younger, exactly. Cleaner. The way a room looks after it has been aired out after a long winter. By the time the others came downstairs, the two of them were sitting with coffee and the windows open, talking with the easiness of people who have cleared something between them and found, on the other side of it, more room than there was before. Paula appeared in the doorway, registered the scene, registered Elizabeth's still pink eyes, looked at Nancy, and had the uncommon wisdom not to ask a single question. She simply poured herself a cup of coffee and sat down with them. And Camille and Simone arrived shortly after, and the morning gathered itself into the kind of conversation that only happens between people who have nothing left to perform for each other. The last days at the coastal estate passed with a quietness that was different in quality from the quietness of the beginning of the trip. It was not the quiet of people who do not yet know what they are to each other. It was the quiet of people who do. They left on a gray morning, carriages loaded, and the Hartford family assembled on the terrace to bid them farewell with the warm sincerity of hosts who had genuinely enjoyed the company. Nancy was the last one out of the house, as she had been the last one in, and she stood for a moment on the front step and looked back at the entrance hall with its sea paintings and its pale stone floors, and then looked out past the garden toward the shoreline. The wooden chair was still there by the water's edge. She picked up her trunk and got into the carriage. The months that followed were ordinary in all the practical ways. The estate accounts required the same attention they always had. The steward wrote with the same frequency. The autumn brought the same administrative pressures that autumn always brought, and Nancy managed them with the same focused competence she brought to everything. rising early and working steadily and going to bed with the satisfaction of a day's work completed. She thought about the coastal estate sometimes. Not constantly, and not painfully. In the way you think about something that mattered. Returning to it occasionally and finding it still intact, still warm. She had been back in her own house for 11 weeks when she heard the sound of a carriage on the gravel drive. She was at her desk. The accounts were open in front of her. The morning light was coming through the study window at the angle it came through at this time of year, low and long, falling across the ledger pages and the edge of her desk, and the cup of tea she had not finished. She heard the carriage. She heard it stop. She heard the footstep on the front path that she had come to know, in a very short time and without intending to. In the same way you come to know the sound of a familiar wind, not by thinking about it, but simply by having paid attention. She did not get up immediately. She sat for a moment with her hands resting on the open ledger, and something rising slowly through her chest that was not surprise, and was not urgency, and was not the careful, managed calm she applied to everything else. It was something she had been carrying since a wooden chair on a private beach, since a narrow tea room in a village, since a balcony in the dark with 20 feet of night air between them, and a silence that had meant something. She closed the ledger. She stood up. She walked to the window first, not to confirm what she already knew, but because she needed one more moment with herself before the door opened. Through the glass she could see the drive, the carriage, the dark coat, the unhurried posture of a man who had said he would come, and had come, not dramatically, not with declaration, but with the simple, grounded reliability of someone who meant what they said. Alfred was looking at the house. Then he looked up, as though he had known she would be at the window, and when he found her there, his expression did not perform anything. It simply settled, the way a room settles when the person it has been waiting for finally walks in. Nancy left the window and walked to the front door. She opened it before anyone else could, which was not the done thing, and which she did not give a single moment's consideration. The morning air came in, cool and carrying the smell of turned earth and the dry, clean scent of the season, and Alfred was standing on the front step in his dark traveling coat, with his hat in one hand, and his expression carrying that quality she had identified in a ballroom, in a tea room, on a balcony. The quality of a man who has nothing to conceal and no interest in concealing it. He said, "Good morning, Miss Holcomb." She said, "You are punctual." He almost smiled. "I said I would come." She stepped back from the door, and he came inside, and the house settled around them with the particular quiet of a place where something is beginning that is going to last a very long time. Nancy Holcomb had packed one trunk for a 10-day house party she had nearly canceled. She had sat in a wooden chair on a private beach and read her book while a room full of women rearranged themselves for a duke she had not bothered to look up for. She had helped a woman with dropped plates because it was the obvious thing to do. She had drunk tea in a narrow room and spoken honestly because she did not know another way to speak. She had not performed a single thing, and it had been the most powerful thing she had ever done. If you have been the one who almost did not show up, the one who packed light and sat apart and thought that being exactly yourself was somehow not enough, this story was written for you. Because Nancy did not change. She did not adjust. She did not perform. And she did not lose herself. She found someone willing to walk through her actual front door and stand in her actual life and choose her, precisely and deliberately, as she was. That is not luck. That is what happens when you stop apologizing for being real. If this story reached you tonight, if any part of it felt like something you needed to hear, then you already know what to do. Hit that subscribe button on Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles right now, because this is only one story in a collection that goes much deeper. Like this video, share it with someone who needs it, and ring that notification bell so you are there when the next one drops. And drop a comment below. Tell me where you are watching from. Tell me what part of Nancy's story stayed with you. Because the person reading your comment is real, and your voice matters in this space. The drama, the secrets, the love that no one saw coming there is so much more waiting for you here. Welcome to the family. We are glad you stayed.